And then we'll just do the music thing into the next thing.
Yeah, basically. That's how podcasts work.
Yep.
Welcome to the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
This is a wholly new podcast where we'll talk about some of the many developments in Swift and the Apple world in a relaxed, fun way. We're just so excited about all the possibilities of working with Swift and Apple's platforms, and we're looking forward to sharing that with all of you. Sean, maybe you want to tell listeners a little bit about our goals.
Yeah, so we're going to record this podcast roughly once every 2 weeks, and we want a lot of feedback from the audience. Some of you may have seen Paul's little incognito tweet about massive view controllers a little bit ago, but that's what we're talking about. We definitely want a lot of audience participation, which you're going to see later on in the show, so be sure to keep an eye out for our tweets.
Every episode, we'll be covering some news from the Swift and iOS community. We'll be talking about new projects, techniques, or tutorials we found in our pick of the week. Plus, we'll have an open ballot where you can air your views on important topics. Speaking of which, let's get on with it.
We're going to kick this show off with the news, and the first topic up for discussion is that the raw strings proposal on Swift Evolution is back in review. Now, at a high level, what this is strings used to require escaping characters, but now you're going to be able to use raw strings to have things like slashes, you know, quotation marks in your string. Now, Paul, I'm fairly new to following the Swift Evolution, just started tracking it, you know, a couple weeks ago. You mentioned this has been kicked around for a while now. So what's that all about?
It's something other languages have, and have for a reason, because backslashes are complicated in Swift. If you want to say, you know, have a quote inside a string, say a quote from a book, for example, inside a string with quote marks, then you have backslash quote. That's an escape character right there. And you want new line, it's backslash N or backslash RN, whatever you're doing, which OS you're using and so forth. And of course, string interpolation, backslash parentheses. But when you want to have things like regular expressions, which themselves have backslashes for escape characters, you have backslash, backslash, or backslash, 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 backslash. And there's a brilliant XKCD cartoon, which we linked to in the show notes, 1638, which goes through sort of levels 1 to 10 or so of backslashes, you know, the one true backslash, the backslash to end all the texts and so forth, because you can have many, many, many. It gets so hard to read, and be able to have a string which to Swift, where everything is literally exactly what it means. So a backslash isn't an escape character, it's literally a backslash, a quote mark is literally a quote mark, and so forth. Eliminates a huge swathe of complexity.
Yeah, and the way I read that proposal, that was the main driver behind it, is readability for sure, like you just mentioned, and then just it opens up the door for many, many errors when, like you said, you have just backslash, 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 all this, you know, just very error prone. So I actually enjoyed reading through this proposal. Again, I'm fairly new to following this stuff, so this is new to me. It was very thorough and very detailed. I particularly like the table towards the bottom of the review where they looked at all these other languages and said, here's how Rust does it. Here's how Python does it.
Which is great because we want Swift to be the best of, you know, multiple worlds. Great artists steal.
right.
Swift yeah. Steal too.
Yeah, exactly. So I really enjoyed how it was a very thorough analyzation of, you know, raw string. So, but I am still slightly confused on this, Paul. Maybe you can help me out here. Is when I started looking at the examples in the proposal, there was so the way they decided to propose doing this was use the pound sign or the hashtag. But some of the examples had one hashtag, multiple hashtags, and that's kind of where it lost me. Did you understand what was going on there?
Yeah. So what it means is by default you'll write a string. You know, let hello equals quote world quote like that. If you need to include quote marks in there, then you start using pound quote or hash quote and then quote hash, and as long as the number of hashes at the beginning match the number at the end, that's the new string delimiter. And what it means you can then do is you can have hash quote inside your text, and you'd start with hash hash quote and then with quote hash hash, and, yeah. and as I said, you're very unlikely to want to ever have this, but it's important that it be there as a flexibility option. And I like the fact that it just gracefully becomes normal strings. It's only a small extension versus some of the other options that were more intrusive.
Right. So I'll be watching with great interest to see how this goes and if it gets approved. Next up, we have a interesting Twitter thread all about dynamic type. And the insights here were that about 40% of users don't use the default text size. And this kind of was obvious to me where people would use a larger text size. Like I've seen my parents do it. I've seen many people's phones where the text size is just huge. What was very interesting was that half of those users that don't use the default text size actually go smaller. And I actually tried this, Paul, and I went all the way down to small, and I loved the way it looked. Like, especially on the iPhone X, I'm always going to call it the X. don't correct me, I'm always calling it the X. It just looked beautiful. However, after a little bit, it did strain my eyes, so I did go up a little bit, but I am now a smaller font user.
I think the introduction of UI font metrics in iOS 11 means that anyone can scale any text to any size, even your custom fonts. So there really is no excuse not to use this kind of thing anymore, particularly because if you do thorough dynamic type testing, then you'll find your UI scales to longer languages like German, where words are naturally just longer. So you can make your whole UI more flexible and more scalable, which helps accessibility and helps other languages too. So it's just a win-win all around.
All right, moving on to the next topic. We just want to touch on this real quick because you've probably inundated with this news. And as you know, the Apple event is coming up on September 12th. Everything leaked. Again, we're not going to talk about the details, but I have a conspiracy theory. Apple said they're going to crack down on leaks. And this leaked during a test stream, which Apple knows people watch. So I'm wondering, do you think Apple is trolling us? Is this them intentionally throwing stuff out there to kind of throw us off the scent? What do you think, Paul?
I think if they did three conflicting live streams, like it's the iPhone XS or XS or the iPhone XY or the X squared, you know, we don't know anymore, you know, it's like a shotgun. That's the idea, disinformation basically. But I am curious to see whether we get new APIs, because obviously last year we had TrueDepth shipping with the iPhone X or iPhone X, you might say. We had the new vibration stuff in the iPhone 7 the year before, so we might see a modified iOS 12 ship with some sort of APIs. I'm not sure what. I guess we'll find out in, 2 weeks or so?
Yeah, or by the time you're listening to this, maybe very soon. Up next, we have Docker support coming to Swift. Now, this is official Docker support. Docker had done something in-house to support Swift. Now, Paul, I don't know too much about Docker. I mean, I've heard of them. I walk by their offices, but I've never actually used them. Maybe help me out and some of the audience. You know, does this affect iOS developers, or is it more about Swift expanding beyond the Apple ecosystem?
Well, it could affect iOS in the longer term, but in the short term, it's really a server-side Swift thing. The way to think about Docker when you're just coming to the first time is something like Parallels or VMware. It lets you run containerized OSs. So you can have Docker running Linux on your Mac. And you can then run Swift inside Docker, inside Linux on your Mac. So it lets you spin up these images very, very quickly. So if you did have a server-side Swift site running somewhere, and you want to deploy to new machines, you say, right, run my Docker installation. It gets the latest Linux, gets the latest Swift, gets the latest code from your GitHub repo, and is pre-configured to work. So it's really nice. And what we're seeing here, which I think is important, is that Apple are recognizing other important open source projects, which historically they've been very, very bad at. So they're really formalizing the process, having an official Swift Docker image, get this thing to run Swift. And they're also saying they're gonna try and split up the capabilities of that into more fine-grained things. So we'll get an image that can run Swift, an image that can build Swift. So if you just want to deploy a Swift server, you haven't got to have the Swift compiler on there. You just need the libraries in there. That's all you need, ready to go. So that'll be lighter and faster. Whereas you want a full compilation version, fine, that'll be available as well, both officially from Apple.
Moving on to the next section, it is our pick of the week. And this is where we pick something we learned this week. So Paul, what did you learn?
Well, a big thing for me this week was a Swift Evolution Proposal 0225, which was to add is even, is odd, and is multiple of to integers in Swift. And I like this, not because of the functionality, which I think is very important, but because it was first discussed as is even and is odd. So you could say 2.isEven equals true and 3.isOdd equals true. But when it hit the evolution community, it got discussed and broadened out in discussion to include an is multiple of method. So you can now say is multiple of 2, is multiple of 3, 4, 5, and so on. And this sparked a big discussion because just doing is even or odd, you know it's not hard because of modulus. So should this kind of thing be added after all? And it really had these echoes of the toggle method that happened for Swift 4.2. And actually, more importantly, it was accepted as is multiple of, with is even and is odd being rejected, because you can basically get is even and is odd by using is multiple of 2. So it wasn't significantly easier to be worth doing. And I think what this shows us is that the Swift evolution community is working. It's working really well. It's doing a good job of analyzing proposals and not just bike shedding names all the time. But this got broadened out into an intelligent, useful addition, then simplified to its fundamentals and accepted.
Yeah, so initially when I heard, you know, is even, is odd got rejected, I was kind of bummed because I like that readability. I'm big on readability in code. But like you just said, when you can just say is multiple of 2, you know, and that's either true or false, there's your is even, is odd. And that is still pretty readable too. So I'm not as bummed anymore that is even and is odd got rejected because I agree with that reasoning.
I guess it depends on what you're trying to do with the functionality. You know, I think is even is odd is the most common because of things like, say, zebra striping for tables, where you have like one rose white, one's gray, one white, one gray, and so forth. But you know, it's a big improvement anyway, you know, and that's a big thing. And what I particularly liked was in approving is multiple of, the core team wrote up some guidelines on what they think makes great additions to the standard library. There's, you know, it's similar to a talk that Ben Cohen did at .swift in Paris this year in January, where he sort of talked about standard library and what it means to get a thing in there. But they gave 4 criteria in there because they recognized that almost all library features can be built using existing features in Swift. So you could, you know, you could do is multiple of yourself in your own code. So why not just do it in your own code? Why put it in the library? And they gave 4 things that they consider important criteria. It could be complex or challenging or error prone to do it yourself in user land. It may have substantial performance advantages. Ben Cohen gives a great example of this in his .swift talk. It might be substantially easier to work with because it works with other language or library features. And it may be what they call more fluent, i.e. more natural to discover, use, and read and code. And this, I think, is where is multiple of works very well. You know, any coder for more than a few years recognize, you know, if i% 2 is 0, right? You know, we see that and go, right, this is zebra striping or equivalent happening here.
And right, like isn't that FizzBuzz, right? FizzBuzz is one of the first thing you do as
right,
a programmer.
Yeah, exactly. In your interview, exactly. And now, thanks to this, it is more fluent, it is more natural to use and read and code.
So my pick this week is going to be SpriteKit. Now, this is what I've been working on at work, actually. And we're not building a game at work, but it is just gamifying a certain part of our app. So basically, the app I'm working on is asthma spirometry for children. So you blow into this device and you shoot a little balloon up on the screen. You collect gems. So and we got to make all these cool worlds. So I'm dealing with collision detection, which that is very easy to do in SpriteKit, surprisingly. I was pretty shocked about that. I did have to use a Hacking with Swift article, shameless plug for my SK contact, you know, delegate. I had to get some confusion there. So thanks for that.
It's a brilliant, beautiful API, and it has been since it launched in iOS 7. And they keep improving it, keep adding things. But, you know, the fact that it goes down to metal, it just makes everything super fast and very powerful at the same time. So it's fun. You know, I don't think many big games are made in SpriteKit because of the want to port to somewhere else, but when you're just learning or having some fun, whatever, you can make games ridiculously easy using the language you love. It's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. I'm having a blast going in every day. Like I say, I get to make these fun little worlds. I'm playing a lot with particle emitters. Now, if you haven't messed with particle emitters, the editor, like in Xcode, is amazing. You're just editing all these particles in real time. Don't get me wrong, there's a lot of dials to tweak, and it might be a little intimidating at first.
A lot of dials to tweak. So many dials.
Like birth rate, you know, alpha. I mean, you can really customize these things to be anything you want. But the great thing about the Xcode editor is that it's all in real time. You're tweaking these dials, and your animation is constantly playing on your screen, and you get to see these changes in real time, which is much better than, you know, there is an alternative to SpriteKit for emitters, right, Paul? The CA emitter?
Yeah, if you're doing UIKit stuff, you can use CA emitter layers, which is a generic CA layer you can place into any UIKit view and render. And it's so similar to the SpriteKit thing. You know, if you did your SpriteKit particles in code, which you can do, it's almost the same as CA emitter layer. But there's no gorgeous particle editor. So it's kind of like change, compile, run,
right.
Nowhere near as nice.
And that's a lot of code, right? There would be so many, you know, emitter.birthrate, emitter.alpha, because there are so many dials. So yeah, it would be a lot of code. But yeah, just having a blast with emitters, making rain levels, you know, tornado dust levels. It's just a ton of fun going to work every day. And so my pick actually is cool to check out SpriteKit, but the book I've been using is Ray Wunderlich's 2D, you know, gaming tutorials. They have sunset that book because, like Paul mentioned earlier, a lot of bigger games are moving to Unity. So there is going to be potentially a gap in the SpriteKit content, except our co-host here, Paul, has a book called... What's it called, Paul?
I have my own SpriteKit book called Dive into SpriteKit. And I'm really proud of it because, obviously, it's a brilliant book. But it's the first book I've ever done which changes its content as you progress through the book. Which I've never seen done before.
Expand on that real quick. I'm not sure what you mean.
As a kid, do you ever read Choose Your Own Adventure books?
Yeah, right. Of course.
Go to page 82. In a dungeon, exactly. Do you want to turn left to page 12, turn right to page 85? As you read the book, it says, okay, do you want this to be about rockets, submarines, or whatever? You tap a link, and the rest of the book changes to match what you chose.
Oh, wow.
Do you want to tap to go up or tap to drop, whatever? And as you choose, the tutorial literally changes itself, and it forks across about 500 different options through the book. So you end up with a unique game that is your customized choice of game.
That sounds very tedious to make. Sounds great for the consumer to go through, don't get me wrong, but I bet that was very tedious to make.
I really enjoyed making it. And even better, you get the whole thing as an iPad app, which you can run, follow the book on one side and play the game on the other side, sort of live as it goes, which is really fun.
And by the way, audience, this was not a commercial for Paul. I just kind of threw that at him. I just want to put that out there. That wasn't
a commercial.
It's a commercial
for SpriteKit, is what it is. SpriteKit is fun.
Yeah. Again, no offense to Paul or anything. I bought the Ray Wunderlich book like 2 years ago, and it's been awesome. But they have sunset it. So you know,
I'm sure it's a great book. But it's an advert for SpriteKit. Is what it is. SpriteKit is fun to work with. It really is fun to dabble with. It's a Cocoa-like API with metal performance. It's just so nice. Next up is our open ballot section, where we put a question out there for you to answer and read the best responses here and have our own feedback too. The question this week is a hot one. How do you avoid massive view controllers? And we got a lot of responses. Even though I tweeted very subtly, this is the pilot podcast. We didn't want to announce just yet. It wanted to be a big surprise. So I didn't mention it was for the podcast, but now you're all finding out it's for the podcast. We got a load of responses from folks, and I'm going to try and dive through as many as we can here. One of the biggest responses was to use child view controllers. So that's view controller containment. Guy Rambo says, composing multiple view controllers together to make a screen and then separating logic into other classes. Swift Monkey said, container views are my favorite. Break things out and make them smaller and easier to reuse. And Daniel Storm agrees as well. He says, break them to child VCs with the parent VCs manage or handle callbacks. Sean, what do you think of controller containment?
Yeah, so this is very, very close to what I do. In fact, mostly what I do with the combination of composition and then major views. Like an example I use right now, I actually just tweeted out a picture of it earlier today, is a charting thing I'm working on. So the chart is the top half of the screen, table view is the bottom half of the screen. That's a perfect example of where I broke out the chart into its own child view controller because we also reuse it, as Swift Monkey mentioned, easier to reuse. So I like these approaches. This is very, very close to what I use. And I like to compare it to a table of contents, if I will. This is how I like my view controllers to read. And what I mean by that is like a high level overview to where if you see a function, you know, you can dive into it. For example, if it's like a table view getting the array that it needs, it's just, you know, array equals, you know, get readings or whatever. And then if the user wants to find out what get readings is about, they can dive in.
The thing is, it's been around since what, iOS 5 or so, view control containment, and it never really has reached the critical mass it ought to have received. You know what, you still see very long view controllers with mixed responsibilities and so forth. And it's a shame because Apple obviously wants us to use this thing, but it's never really picked up, which is such a real shame.
It's weird because I actually just started recently using them, probably within the past 6 months. So, you know, for those that don't know me, I'm about three and one quarter year into my career. So, and I just started kind of dabbling in this. So yeah, it's not obvious. And there's not a lot of like learning material out there that really recommends this approach.
So another option was architectures. Shai Mishali said, listing logic into other proper objects, be it a view model, coordinator, whatever you'd like that would separate concerns and make the VC only responsible for presentation and layout. And Andy Warwick says, even further, if a class without the UI prefix is in your view controller, reconsider, it's the best place for it. So, you know, a lot of folks chimed in saying things like MVVM or even RX or similar. There was a few MVPs, a few folks recommended Viper. And I'm not disagreeing with them. I think, it, you know, getting the right architecture matters, obviously. It's fundamental to your app, ultimately. But I wouldn't want to say, hey, I've got a big view controller here, let's switch to RX or MVVM or something like that. That's not the reason I'd choose those architectures. You know, you would make the same big mistake. You know, you'd have a huge view model or a huge, right. presenter. You know, you can make the same mistakes absolutely everywhere in any architecture. So I'd look to kind of fix the mistakes in MVC or whatever you had currently. If that then doesn't work, look at refactoring.
I like Andy's answer here. I hadn't really thought about this, where he says, you know, if a class without the UI prefix is in your view controller, reconsider if that's the best place for it. And that kind of goes back to kind of what I said earlier about how I kind of structure my view controllers, making them very readable. That's what's responsible for your presentation, and that's it. So kind of like what you said, I don't think the architecture is the answer to the problem, right? Like, 'cause like you said, every architecture can have these issues.
A third option was looking at single responsibility. We had Ivan Ivanovich saying, it's probably very obvious, but adhere to single responsibility principles and don't make your view controller a jack of all trades, i.e. a delegate, a data source, and so on. Axel Rust says, his goal is no VC longer than 300 lines. David Long had a talk, I think, 300 line view controllers or bust. Mohammed Azam says, structure your code in layers. Data source layer, network layer, reusable controls, and so forth. Follow SRP, the single responsibility principle, and once you follow them, you end up with a much leaner controller. And Colin Laffan recommends using extensions to split the controller logic up, which is interesting because extensions, that way, I guess you'd say the responsibility is this part of your logic and this part of the logic by file.
Yeah, so I split up my, you know, for example, Ivan used the, you know, table view, data source, and delegate. I break that out to an extension, but I had a question. When I read his tweet, I was wondering if maybe I was doing it incorrectly, because I usually put, again, the data source and delegate in an extension, but that is not like really moving it out of the view controller, right? It's just an extension on the view controller. Am I misunderstanding that?
Yeah, so it's I think Colin and Ivan have different approaches here, because it's possible to use extensions in a variety of ways, some to do like, you know, protocol conformance, some to do just simply splitting up files by what they do. And for me, I would make the data source a different object entirely, not an extension. That is a new custom NS object to handle table view data sources. Whereas delegates gets kind of messy, because that's when something's been selected. What do you want to do with it? It has to go somewhere and do something. So often I'll do data source in an object and delegate inside the view controller, or if I can find its own object, but then it's a very, very slim implementation. So I think Colin and Ivan have got different ideas of what that means. Is it single responsibility for the view controller or for the files they're inside? And both have advantages. Both kind of work.
Right. Yeah, that's what kind of threw me off. But on to Axel's no longer than 300 lines. I'm a little more strict. If my view controllers get over 200 lines, I start to sweat a little, start to panic. I don't like that. So I'm definitely a fan of the sentiment there.
Another popular idea was coordinators. Alexander Vacic said, it's hard to choose between coordinators and embedded controllers. For him, coordinators are always the default because they flatten the app hierarchy, which he finds very useful, but they require simple screens. Josh Adams also mentions coordinators and links to a great article by Sarush Kanlu, one of my favorite iOS speakers. He actually pioneered them on iOS, and I'm probably trying to put that link in the show notes. I actually use coordinators myself. I've switched to them from child view controllers. Well, it's not exclusive, but I use coordinators much more now. I find they are a brilliant way of reusing content more easily. For example, I have this app I did recently for doing Swift learning, and you can practice things or do them in challenges, and they both point to different coordinators, so I can move things around on the fly and readjust my entire app flow in a line of code. It's quite beautiful. Have you used them before?
No, they sound great. I was actually introduced to them by your recent articles that you put out on them. I featured them in Swift News a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago. They sound very interesting. I just haven't had a chance to actually implement them in a project yet.
We had a couple of fun responses from Dave Shukin and Paul Bruneau. Dave says, simple, just put everything in your app delegate. Yes, win. And Paul says, read my book, How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love Massive View Controllers. Of course, you can just suck it down and enjoy them all you want to, can't you?
Yeah, there was another one that I thought was pretty funny where, I can't remember who said it, apologies for the attribution here, but it was just stop typing when you feel like it and start a new file. I got a good laugh out of that one.
And finally, a nice pragmatic one to end on. Reza Shirazian says, understand the problem you're trying to solve and pick an appropriate design pattern that makes sense for that problem. There are no magic bullets.
So that wraps up the very first episode of Swift Over Coffee. Speaking of Swift Over Coffee, that is the Twitter handle. Go ahead and follow at Swift Over Coffee because the next open ballot is going to be what makes a great job interview for a Swift developer. So I can't wait to hear everybody's thoughts on that because the interview can be a hot topic, you know, whiteboard, not whiteboard, you know, we'll get into that next episode. So please subscribe to the podcast. Again, this is the very first episode. We're going to be releasing these about every 2 weeks. So we love your support. Love to hear your reviews. So again, that wraps it up. We'll see you next week.
Bye.